I want you to listen very carefully to the noise. You'll hear the receiver background. Then you will hear this incredible noise that comes up. It's 100 kilohertz wide, and it's a total mystery. Here's the noise. And then boom, like somebody threw a switch, it's gone. If you have a hint or know what that noise is, I would appreciate a response at the following email address. K-I, that's the way he'd say it, K-I-6-G-U at pacbell.net. That's K-I-6-G-U at pacbell.net. And we would all appreciate any information you might be willing to spill about that strange noise in a place where it ought not be. Once again, that email address is ki6gu at pacbell.net. Now, I received the following from Whitley Strieber about an hour before airtime. Evidence past climate change happened in hours. Now, this will be up on Whitley's site by now or shortly. Discovery of a 5,200-year-old soft-bodied plant frozen in glacial ice in Peru reveals evidence of a massive and long-lasting climate change that took place in hours. In order for the plant to have been quick frozen rather than killed by frost, it must have been covered by a massive snowfall that took place over just a few hours. Since then, the plant has remained frozen and has not yet been thawed. Meaning once this snowfall took place, no melt occurred for over 5,000 years. Scientists are working to understand the mechanism behind what is being called an astounding finding. Historical data indicates there was a sudden worldwide climate event about 5,200 years ago, but until this finding, it had not been realized that at least in some areas of the world, it brought a total transformation of the whatever climate was there, one to grow green things, right? From temperate to freezing in perhaps as little as a few days, and that change became permanent. If such an event were to occur again, it would cause, without question, worldwide chaos and deaths, maybe in the billions, possibly the collapse of civilization. Scientists are urgently seeking answers in the ice fields of the Peruvian highlands. And you'll find that posted up on Unknown Country any time now. Now, I'm about to introduce Ramon Lopez, Professor Lopez, actually, who is a C-sharp Cook Distinguished Professor in the Department of Physics, University of Texas, El Paso, received his B.S. in physics in 1980 from the University of Illinois, his M.S. And Ph.D. in space physics in 1982 and 1986, respectively, from Rice University. His current research focuses on dynamics of space, the space environment, and comparisons between global computer simulations of the magnetosphere and observations. He's authored and co-authored 68 scientific publications, 17 non-scientific publications, including the popular science book Storms from the Sun, to be released May 14, 2002, by the Joseph Henry Press. He is a fellow of the American Physical Society, a member of the Committee on Undergraduate Science Education of the National Research Council, has served as the chair or member on several committees of the American Geophysical Union and the American Physical Society. From 1994 through 99, was Director of Education and Outreach Programs of the American Physical Society. Dr. Lopez is active in science education reform, both locally and nationally, has served as an education consultant for a number of school districts around the country, state education agencies in California, Maryland, North Carolina, Texas, and for organizations including Discovery Communications, Inc., the National Science Resources Center, and various government agencies. In other words, he's an expert on the sun. Now, here is Professor Lopez. Professor, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks, Art.
You're very, very welcome. I mentioned to you briefly before the program, I've been a ham operator licensed since, I don't know, 58 or so, a long time. And I have watched sun cycles come and go, and I've watched them on a daily basis. I look at the all the charts, the X-rays, the proton flux, all the rest of it every day. And so I've watched the behavior of our sun for all those years daily. That doesn't make me an expert. It still makes me an amateur. But I have never in all my life seen any behavior from our sun that rivals what just happened in the last couple of weeks. What's up?
Well, hard to say, but it has been pretty spectacular. And you're right. There's nothing really to rival that last flare that we had on November 4th. I mean, that's the largest explosion that has been recorded on the sun by modern scientific instruments. It's hard to say whether it's the largest solar flare in recorded history, because in 1859 there was an enormous solar flare that caused a huge magnetic storm on Earth. It was the first documented case of real space weather, and in fact the magnetic storm produced by the coronal mass ejection from the flare knocked out telegraph communications in Europe and North America for the better part of a week.
Would that have been during a solar maximum?
I'm not sure, to tell you the truth, if it was solar max.
Or close to it?
Yeah. I'm not entirely sure, really.
Okay, I'm hearing some sort of behind-the-scenes words that there are observations going on now of gigantic, their words, explosions on the far side of the sun, and they're able to observe this only by apparently looking at the CME as it ejects beyond the rim of the sun, but they're observing explosions. Does that surprise you?
No, it doesn't surprise me at all. And in fact, I looked at the data myself, and there are very large explosions going off on the far side of the sun. It is most likely that same active sunspot region, region 486, that blasted us a couple of weeks ago.
Okay.
And that one may come back around. The sun has a rotation period of about 27 days. Uh-huh. So in a couple of weeks, we may see it again, and we may be in for some more magnetic storms.
Well, there's a couple of possibilities. One, it would, of course, have diminished in size by the time it comes back around. But then there's always that slim possibility that this is a monster that won't quit and in fact, gets even bigger. That is within the realm?
That certainly is. We really don't know.
We don't know until
we see it.
we don't know as much as we might about the sun, period, huh?
That's right. We don't know why the sunspot cycle is 11 years long. We don't know why sometimes it gets stronger and weaker. We don't know why the solar magnetic activity seems to have been increasing for the past 100 years, and we don't know why in the 1600s solar magnetic activity more or less shut off during a period called the Maunder Minimum.
Yeah, I just read an article last night from the New Scientist that indicates that over the last 1150 years, and they found this out by measuring the amount of beryllium-10 that they found in ice core samples, that for the last 1,150 years, the solar activity in general has been very, very low. I mean, it's not like this is just sort of a repeat cycle of something that's even common in the last 1,150 years. The sun just has not, in that period of time, according to this beryllium-10 thing, the sun is really misbehaving at the moment. I mean, compared to what we know about the past.
It's entirely possible. I haven't seen this report, but this idea of looking for beryllium, that's a proxy for solar magnetic activity, because that's being produced by cosmic rays, and the amount of cosmic rays that hit the Earth is impacted by the solar magnetic activity and the solar wind magnetic field.
Exactly.
Stronger solar wind magnetic field acts as a bigger obstacle, if you will, to the cosmic rays.
You obviously must have seen the movie The Core.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just saw it recently, and I thought, oh, here's going to be a real B-class science fiction movie. But when I watched it, I went, wow, the science in this is pretty right on the mark, I thought. I mean, there were, you know, unobtainium and that kind of thing. But aside from that, the rest of the science I thought was pretty cool.
It was a goof. I enjoyed watching the movie, but I got to tell you, the science was all wrong.
All wrong.
all wrong.
Well,
I mean,
the unobtainium.
Part of my pleasure was sort of laughing at some of this stuff. I mean, it's kind of cool to have people talking about space weather and magnetospheres and such in science fiction movies, but unfortunately, they got the science all wrong. But
yeah, let's try a question then, based perhaps on a little bit of that. When let's say we have one of these mega flares, and she's pointed right at Earth, and boom, it hits the Earth, and it hits the magnetic field. When it hits the magnetic field, what does that do to the magnetic field when it really gets hit hard?
Well, it compresses the Earth's magnetic field, but it's not the actual pressure of the blast that's important. It's a more subtle thing. It's how much magnetic field is in the cloud that came from the sun, and what direction was that magnetic field pointing?
The polarization.
If the magnetic field is pointing southward in the solar wind, then it can interconnect with Earth's northward magnetic field, and you can transfer energy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really, it's this transfer of energy. It's sort of like a big electric dynamo out in space. That's what drives currents in Earth's upper atmosphere. That's what produces the aurora. It's an indirect effect.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a monster blast from the sun, then you will significantly compress the Earth's magnetic field, and you could, if the cloud's magnetic field is pointing in the right way, have a big storm. And this is exactly what happened in 1859, that aurora was seen over Havana, Cuba, and Galveston, Texas, and off the coast of Nicaragua, and places where you never see the aurora. And it really scared the bejesus out of people.
I'll bet it did.
Like this.
Yeah.
But it knocked out the most advanced technology that humans had at the time. It knocked out the telegraph, made it really unusable for the better part of a week. So now people back in 1859 were not so dependent on electromagnetism and the technology of harnessing electricity and magnetism.
Mm-hmm.
We are critically dependent on it now.
Oh, yes.
We had one of these monster magnetic storms, we could end up losing a lot of spacecraft, which represents a significant part of the communications infrastructure.
Of course it does. We lost a spacecraft, I'm trying to remember what, I think it was SpaceNet 4, and gosh, all the ATMs went down, and...
That was Galaxy 4.
Galaxy 4, thank you.
In May of 1998, yeah, it was carrying somewhere between 80 and 90% of the pager traffic. It was carrying all the NPR feeds. I mean, anybody who works at an NPR station remembers that day, the day that they lost their feed and they had all this dead airtime they had to fill.
All right. Now, let me hit you with a scenario and see what you say. The Earth gets hit with a large event. The magnetic field becomes compressed. But instead of just one large event, we get peppered with one after another large event that keeps hitting the Earth's magnetic field, battering it. What are the possibilities? Have you ever considered that?
Well, you could just have very strong storminess for a very long time. And again, that's more or less what happened in 1859. That's why it was a whole week that the telegraph was having severe difficulties. And if we had that kind of thing today, and you would just have ongoing magnetic storms, and radiation levels in space would climb to very high levels. And
how much danger for the astronauts in that kind of
situation? The astronauts, not very much, to tell you the truth. They're at such low altitudes. People don't realize just how close the space shuttle and space station fly. They're only a few hundred kilometers up. Communication satellites are out, you know, at 6.6 Earth radii from the center of the Earth, so they're pretty far out there, 22,500 miles above the surface of the Earth. So those are the spacecraft that can be battered by the radiation zones, and if they sit in regions of high radiation for a long time, then their electronics can start to have problems.
Professor,
and in this last set of storms, there were two Japanese satellites that did have problems.
That's what I heard. Professor, hold it right there, and we'll be right back. You'll have to excuse me, Professor. I almost missed a commercial break, and those Los Angeles people, you just know they'd get just so upset when I miss breaks. There you are. So we did lose a couple of, a couple Japanese satellites had a problem. I thought most of them had been hardened against this sort of thing.
Well, many spacecraft have been hardened. Engineers are starting to learn, but it's always hard to tell, you know, how much design do you put in to a spacecraft? Because protecting against these kinds of things is just an expensive proposition, especially when you're talking about designing specialty computer chips. So what I heard was that one Japanese satellite went into what's called safe mode. It was having a problem. It shut itself down. And then there was another one that they lost communications with. They're not really sure what happened, and they don't know if they're going to be able to talk to it again.
Okay. With respect to the core, again, the movie, if we had no magnetic field on Earth, what would these storms do then?
Well, if we had no magnetic field on Earth, actually, you know, the monster solar eruptions would not cause too much of a disturbance here on Earth. It's kind of, the Earth's magnetic field extends pretty far out into space, and so that makes the Earth's magnetosphere a much larger obstacle to catch the energy from these big clouds. But if we didn't have a magnetic field, we'd have far, far more serious problems. Cosmic ray flux here on the Earth would be much higher than it is now.
Cancer rates
would be a lot higher if we didn't have a magnetic field. And there's some question as to whether we'd even have an atmosphere. Because to what extent would the solar wind have, as the solar wind is hitting the Earth's atmosphere directly over, you know, billions of years, how much of it would it have taken off the surface of the Earth? And that probably would happen to a large part of Mars's atmosphere. I mean, Mars is also smaller, so it didn't have as much gravity as the Earth to hold on to its atmosphere. But certainly erosion by the solar wind contributed to the loss of the Martian atmosphere.
Really? And when solar flares hit Mars now?
Nothing much happens except that the radiation levels will increase on the surface of Mars.
But if man were walking on the surface of Mars,
he'd be in trouble.
He'd be in how much trouble?
Well,
because we do plan a mission, you know.
Yeah, you're not going to fall over dead walking on the surface of Mars just because of one solar flare, but you're going to get a significant dose of radiation. And in fact, that's a serious, serious problem. It's not only just walking on the surface of Mars where there's very little atmosphere and essentially no magnetic field to protect you, but it's also just the trip from Earth to Mars and back. You're exposed to galactic cosmic rays, and you're exposed to high-energy particles generated from the sun, and you're exposed to high-energy particles generated by shock waves from these clouds that go exploding through the solar wind. So that's a very, very serious problem.
Well, yes, serious enough that it would actually prevent humans from safely going to Mars?
It would if you didn't take care of it. I mean, you have to have a storm shelter. You have to have some place where you can go where there's a lot of material between you and the radiation, so the radiation can be stopped in that material.
Well, lead is very expensive to put into orbit.
You bet. That's going to be a problem. Probably the easiest solution would be to, fling up a few tons of lunar dirt and pack it around, the central core of a spacecraft. Because if you're going to go to Mars, you're going to have to build something pretty big.
Once again, Professor Lopez. Professor, welcome back.
Thanks.
Let's see. I read a recent Science article that indicated that, contrary to what was believed earlier, I guess our sun is considered to be a fairly stable sun as suns go. There was some recent evidence that even stable suns seem to occasionally go berserk for reasons unknown, and not necessarily supernova, but do something so disagreeable that it could virtually sterilize planets like ours, in their immediate vicinity.
There might be stars that do things like that, but I don't think that those are sun-like stars. people have been observing sunlight stars for the past 30, 40 years. And, yeah, they do sometimes do strange things. And we know, for example, that other stars have magnetic activity cycles, like our sun.
Right.
And sometimes they turn on and sometimes they turn off.
Mm-hmm.
And our sun also exhibits that kind of behavior. So the sun could do things that could affect our technology. But remember, the sun's been around for billions of years, and there's no evidence anywhere in the geological record that it has ever done anything that would have, you know, that kind of an impact on...
And I'm sure it'll be around for billions of years yet to come. And our very own Earth has been around a very long time. Contrary, though, we haven't been around that long.
That's true. But we can look back to the geologic records, and we don't see any evidence of that kind of dramatic change. But nonetheless, the sun can have changes as... And you know, these massive sunspots during a time when it's supposed to be solar minimum is
yeah.
an example of that.
Yeah.
And actually, it is kind of interesting because you got to wonder what exactly is going on with the sun, because
yes.
the solar cycle does seem to have been intensifying over the past 100 years. There's evidence that the solar wind magnetic field has been getting stronger, in fact, doubling over the past 100 years, and maybe this kind of activity at what we normally call solar minimum is just part of this a little bit more magnetically active sun.
Hmm.
And that has direct implications for our technology, because we depend on electricity and magnetism for everything.
And there are many people who believe that comets are to some degree responsible, and there are stories going around that comets are causing this a disturbance on the sun. Comets actually hitting the sun.
No. Wouldn't do anything.
Comets do
hit the sun. And in fact, if your viewers go to the SOHO website to see images of the sun, they can get pictures. You know, they've got some movies of comets going and crashing, maybe not actually hitting the sun, but coming close enough that they vaporize. So they go around the sun. They don't come back the other side.
Okay, but they wouldn't be the causative agent of these monstrous sunspots and then these explosions.
No, this is something deep inside the sun. This is something that sun's dynamics and nothing in the solar system is going to affect that.
Do we think it does
point out the need for prediction.
Yes.
And knowing something about what space weather is doing and being able to warn satellite operators and power grid operators. I think that's why we didn't see more bad effects in this last round of activity, because people knew it was coming.
They got warned, yeah.
But you know what's very interesting is right at the time when all of this activity was going on, there was a hearing in the House of Representatives to review funding for the Space Environment Center, the place in Boulder, Colorado, that does space weather prediction, because in the budget they're zeroed out,
wiped out
of the budget.
Yeah, we should observe. Here's one for you. We can't look at the other side of the sun for the most part, right?
Right.
Should we be able to? In other words, prediction would certainly improve incredibly. The way I understand it, we've got a satellite out about 1 million miles from Earth, between Earth and the sun, so that we can look at what's actively going on, at what's pointed toward Earth. What do you think of the concept of getting a satellite about as far away from the sun over on the other side that could relay information about... Then just think, Professor, what that would do for forecasting.
It's a great idea. And in fact, what we really need is like several of them stationed in Earth orbit around the sun so that we can develop stereo pictures of the sun. And there is actually an idea for a mission called STEREO that's supposed to fly sometime in the next decade or so, that will put one satellite ahead of the Earth and one satellite behind the Earth in the Earth orbit so that we can get a stereo view, at least on this side of the sun. Putting them on the other side of the sun, that presents more of a challenge and be a lot more expensive. But, absolutely, if we could do that, then we could have great prediction.
Now, there's also a great controversy, Professor, about whether the sun and its activity affect weather on Earth. Now, I guess the jury is still out on this one, or what are your thoughts?
Well, you have to distinguish between weather and climate. I mean, weather is short-term stuff, like is it going to rain today or not? The climate is long-term. I live in El Paso. It's a very dry climate.
Mm-hmm.
We're never going to get a lot of rain. There might be days that we have rain, but in general, we get a small amount of rain a year. And climate, there is evidence that solar activity does affect climate.
Uh-huh.
Weather, uh-huh. No, it's not. You know, a magnetic storm does not mean that we're going to have a hurricane.
Sorry. I should have. I meant climate, so I should have really said that. But you're thinking yes. You're thinking yes, huh?
There's evidence, and there's also physical mechanisms. How would this work that's plausible, that fits within physical laws? So, yeah, there's a mechanism, and there's some evidence that that, yes, when the sun has greater magnetic activity, the Earth warms up. So global warming is a fact. It's been observed Earth is getting warmer. The real question is how much was caused by humans versus how much was being caused by the sun.
Indeed. And do you have any thoughts?
I don't know. I am pretty convinced that some of the global warming that we have seen over the past 100 years is solar in origin.
I mean, even the common person sort of puts that together easily. More activity from the sun, more radiation, more effect on Earth. The sun does affect us, after all. And if it's got a lot more energy, then it's transferring it one way or the other to Earth, and it gets warmer here. Duh.
It's actually a pretty complicated chain of events. It's through the cosmic rays.
I bet it is.
That people think that this works in high-altitude clouds. So that when you've got a lot of solar wind magnetic field, you don't have a lot of cosmic rays, so you don't have a lot of high-altitude clouds, so more sunlight hits the Earth instead of being reflected. That's the chain of events that people have talked about. And it's something that's physically plausible that could be responsible for some of the global warming. There's just so much that we don't understand.
Yes, there is, and there needs to be money made available. I mean, after all, we can ship $87 billion or whatever it is over to Iraq to rebuild that country and so forth and so on. So why aren't we spending money, you know, to look at our own very important environment? You said it yourself. I mean, we're filled with chips from end to end. They mean everything now in this country. And if we were to get hit really hard without warning, oh, that would be expensive, Professor, very expensive.
It could be really bad. And so, actually, the sun did us a favor with these storms, you know, a couple of weeks ago, because those storms hit just at the time that Congress was talking about, should we zero out the Space Environment Center?
You almost might call it a shot across the bow, huh?
Exactly. Yeah. So it was perfectly timed, and I'm glad to say that the session went very well in the House. It was chaired by Vern Ehlers, who's a physicist, by the way, one of two physicists in the Congress. And I'm very hopeful that in conference, the Senate and the House will come together and say, we cannot afford not to have space weather predictions.
Very good.
And your listeners, if you guys want to call your congressman or senator and tell them that we need to have space weather prediction and we need the Space Environment Center, do it.
I mean, for example, right now, sunspot number 486, let's assume the worst and that it's growing and growing and growing. And if we had a satellite on the other side of the sun, we'd be able to say, hey, everybody, tinfoil hat time or whatever, because here she comes.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see in a week when it comes around the limb of the sun, if it's still there and if it's still as monstrous as it was before.
Indeed so.
And if it is growing, who knows, maybe we'll have another, you know, super flare like the 1859.
Well, right, exactly. Now, Professor, another interesting thing happened. As I say, I watch on a daily basis, and holy mackerel, when those gigantic spots finally rotated away on the other side of the sun, the charts dropped like a rock. I mean, I never saw it. It was like, you know, the patient just died, and it was way down just flat in the B area. Just amazing. Actually, how quiet it suddenly got, and now it's like the giant quiet before the storm.
Exactly.
you see
well,
it the same way.
There's storming going on, but as you say, it's on the other side of the sun, and we know that stuff is blowing off in the other direction.
Yes.
We just have to wait to see what happens in a couple of weeks.
Is it unusual, Professor, when you take the sun as a whole, that these monstrous spots would congregate kind of in one area and then be so quiescent on the other side? Isn't that strange?
I'm actually not sure how strange that is, because you get all kinds of behavior from the sun, and there are plenty of times I've seen that one, you know, the side that's facing us doesn't have any sunspots, but there seems to be magnetic activity on the other side. But the difference is so huge, if they're as big as they were when it was facing us, that does seem a little bit odd to me.
Yeah.
But not my field exactly, so I can't say if how many other times people have seen that kind of behavior.
Professor, what's at the core of the sun?
The core?
The core.
A very large fusion reaction where hydrogen, basically protons for the most part, are being smashed together because the temperatures are so high and they're moving so quick, they can overcome the electrical repulsion. And they can get close enough where the nuclear force can take over and then fuse them into helium nuclei. And when that happens, the product weighs less than what went into the reaction. And the extra mass, the missing mass, appears as energy. And that's what powers the sun. That's what powers an H-bomb. Same process.
And the sun, I've heard, is much hotter on the outside than it is down near the core. Is that true or false?
That is false. The core is hotter than the atmosphere of the sun. But the atmosphere is a couple of million degrees. The visible surface is only 6,000 degrees in Celsius, Kelvin, actually, degrees Kelvin, so 12,000 degrees Fahrenheit, roughly. So the atmosphere is much hotter than the surface, but the core is still hotter than the atmosphere.
Anybody have any idea by how much?
Yeah, actually, I don't remember the number for exactly the temperature of the core. We've got a surprisingly good idea of the overall basic structure of the sun. The sun is always quivering like a big bowl of Jell-O, and we can make observations of that shaking and use it to probe the inside of the sun in the same way that we use earthquakes to probe the inside of the earth because of the sound waves traveling through the earth.
Right.
And so there's a field called helioseismology, the seismology of the sun, and they've got pretty good evidence of the basic structure of the sun.
That's really fascinating. What's the difference between a flare and this coronal mass ejection? Are they one and the same? How do we differentiate between the two?
They're not exactly the same. They usually come together, but they don't always have to. A coronal mass ejection is a huge cloud of electrically conducting gas and magnetic field that lifts off from the sun and hurtles out into space. And when these things hit us, then sometimes we get magnetic storms. The flare is a sudden release of energy stored in the solar magnetic field near the surface of the sun. And it's like a big explosion. And sometimes the big explosion is associated with one of these big clouds that blows out into space. In fact, quite often they're associated, but they don't have to be. But these big flares that we saw all had big coronal mass ejections associated with them.
Yes. Have they settled, by the way, on the size of this most recent incredible explosion? Was it, I've heard various figures. It ranged from, I think, about X28 is the last one I saw, which seems, and maybe you can tell me a little bit about the scale.
Right.
X20, I believe, was the top of the scale, wasn't it?
It used to be.
Used to be is right, because I guess we need more instruments, different instruments.
Well, the thing is that the flare on November 4th did actually saturate the detectors, and they had to try to figure it out from other means, just really how big it was. And you're correct, it was. They've settled on X28. The way that they classify flares is by how much power there is, how many watts per square meter in a certain range of X-ray wavelengths from 1 to 8 angstroms.
Yes.
That window, just how much power in that little window is there. And
Professor, quick question. Is the scale linear or...
No,
is
it's logarithmic.
It's logarithmic. So, uh-huh. So.
Yeah, so an X28 is... 2.8 times more powerful than an X10, right? So I said that wrong. I gave you a linear scale. No, it is logarithmic. So yes.
Okay,
the next 28 is a lot bigger than the next 10.
Okay. Why did they presume that that an X20, let's say, would be the biggest amount of energy release they would ever see from the sun? Because obviously you've got to have, you're going to set up your scale as, well, there's the biggest thing that could ever happen, but whoops, something bigger happened.
Well, they hadn't actually set an upper limit to the scale. What they had set is an upper limit to the detectors, and figuring that, well, we hadn't seen anything bigger than this, and so we're probably not, and that was not correct. The previous record was an X20 flare.
So what do you think they're recalibrating to right now?
Well, the instruments that are up there are the ones that are going to be up there for a while, so we won't have any other X-ray instruments that have got that are able to record higher power levels, and they'll just do it the way that they do it now.
Let me restructure my question. If we were to launch another satellite tomorrow, the instruments would be capable of recording how big a flare, do you suppose?
You might want to go up to X40, X50. Something like that.
X40 or X50.
Yeah, and let me tell you, Art, this is just totally a guess. The biggest thing that we've got on record for 40-some years is X28. So let's go ahead and make an X50. And who knows, that might not be enough either to capture some flares.
Uh-huh.
You never know.
Well, see, that's the whole thing about the sun and what's going on right now. It really does come down to that. We just don't know, do we?
There's a lot we don't know. That's right. There's a lot we do know, but there's still, why these big sunspots during solar minimum? We don't know. In 2 weeks when this thing is dead on the Earth's sun line again, is it going to be still another monster? Are we going to get even a bigger flare than the X28? We don't know. Just have to wait and see.
Is there any way to explain the dynamics that causes the sunspot or the hole itself?
Yeah, people have done a lot of work with trying to understand the nature of sunspots, and it has to do with the differential rotation of the sun. The sun does not rotate with the same same angular speed at all latitudes. So some latitudes run faster than others, and that twists up the solar magnetic field. And that twist represents stored energy. Any kind of twisted magnetic field, just like a twisted rubber band,
uh-huh,
represents stored energy. And so sometimes these twisted bundles of magnetic field become actually buoyant and float up through and pop through the surface of the sun, pushing a little bit of the solar gases out of the way.